Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show live on tnsradio.com. This evening I've got Grayling Barraclough with me, who is making a documentary, an extensive documentary, about the state of the system that we're living in. Thanks for coming and talking to me, Grayling.
Thanks, Dr. Rock. Thanks for having me on.
So what made you approach the system as a fairly substantial kind of thing to be approaching, fairly serious piece of work? Why did you start off with such a big one?
Well, just to sort of introduce it, really, I'm sure many of your listeners, most of your listeners, have probably heard of an author called George Orwell, and they're probably familiar with a number of his works. Certainly people in the truth movement have heard of this author, and they've looked into the things that he's been saying. One of his works that perhaps, it's not the most popular one, it's not the most well-known one, but it's certainly one of my favourites, if not my favourite, and that's a factual work called The Road to Wigan Pier. And if anyone hasn't read that book, then I'd certainly advise you to read it, the first half of it at least. It is split into two parts. It's the first half that I'm interested in, and it's the first half really that inspired me to undertake this project, one of the things that did. And what The Road to Wigan Pier is, it's a factual book, and it documents George Orwell's journeys around the northwest of England. Now, I'm from Preston in Lancashire in the northwest of England. And he travels all around the northwest, and he just basically writes about his findings. He's a journalist. He writes about the ordinary people, what they're getting up to in their ordinary lives, the working conditions. You've got to remember, he was writing in the mid-1930s during a depression. You know, certainly there's a big depression in America. I'm sure people are familiar with that, but there's also a depression over here too. And times were really hard for people. And when you read about it and the sort of things they had to go through, my word, it's... It really, really does bring things into perspective for people in their lives today of just how hard our ancestors at that time had it. I mean, there were good points as well. Some things, as I point out in the documentary, some things were better then than they are now. Some things were worse. So why is this important? Why is it such an important work, The Road to Wigan Pier? Well, it's important because I believe it's a factual account of his movements at that time. Now, it's really, really important that we document our own history, because what most people in the truth movement will be aware of is that history, as George Orwell points out in one of his other books, is basically a fiction most of the time when you look at it. Certainly official history, the sort of history they teach in the schools about World War II, all these other things, we basically have the anorexic threads of history given to us. How much we can actually rely on this history is highly, highly debatable, when there's certain quite large aspects of history that have been falsified. And just to give you an example of that, how quickly they falsify it, certainly, if you look at 9/11, well, the next day it was pretty much a false account. They'd already falsified history after a day by telling you know, that it was this guy in a turban that was in a cave in Afghanistan somehow managing to orchestrate this. I mean, it's almost laughable, this amazing kind of deed where apparently these aeroplanes fell into the building and the buildings collapsed. I don't want to get into that now, but hopefully people understand what I mean. So it's really important that we document our own history, because we cannot rely on any historian at any university to do that. Anyone on the payroll, really, of the establishment is not going to document history in a correct or a proper way. And it's really interesting in this country about, you know, we talk about the corporations and businesses getting bigger. It's difficult to get things published nowadays, and it's difficult to get things into the mainstream. Academic papers have to be peer-reviewed. If you want to put something out there that challenges history, revisionist history, certainly, you can get yourself in trouble. In some countries, you can get put in jail for doing that. That's how serious it is. So I had a real desire to kind of follow in Orwell's footsteps, and I still haven't done that project to the extent that I would have liked to do in terms of following up The Road to Wigan Pier to that extent. But certainly that was an inspiration for this documentary, because this is just more of a wider look at the system that we have. And the reason that it's important, and the reason that it ties in with Orwell, is that, and it's a controversial point this, and most people will probably disagree with me, but in my opinion, and certainly what I found while doing this documentary, things haven't changed, okay? certainly not from the 1930s, things have not changed. And I was sat in a pub the other day, and I was speaking to two old guys, two old timers, both guys in the 70s, yeah? One's a very good friend of mine, and this other guy was a friend of his. And they started on this old talk, and you hear this all the time from older people, about how things have changed, how much things have changed. Oh, what's changed? And one of them started going, they're both from Blackburn, these guys, but we were in Preston at the time. And they were talking about the milk round. And he was saying, well, when I were a lad, as they say in Lancashire, the milk used to come round on a cart, a horse and cart. I thought, well, yeah, fair enough. It used to come round on a horse and cart. It comes round by a van now. It doesn't even come round a van, does it? Because the kids nick it otherwise. It comes around, you buy it from the shop or whatever, yeah? But has it really changed? If it's a horse and cart or a van, it doesn't matter. You know, people used to say, oh, well, I used to write letters. You know, when I left university, you didn't exchange emails. You gave them your parents' address and they used to write to you. And I'm not that old, you know, that's not that long ago. But really, what's the difference between email and a letter? The medium's changed. But it's no different. It's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. And there's a brilliant quote. I can't remember where it comes from, but I use it in the documentary. And it basically says, in order for things to stay the same, they have to change. And think about that for a minute. It's very true. In order to give the illusion that things are changing and things are moving on, they have to give us all these new gadgets, like the ones we're looking at now, these computers, microphones, mixing desks, God knows what, yeah? To give the impression, the false illusion that things are changing, nothing is changing. We were enslaved then, in Orwell's day, we're enslaved now. Things were hard then, they're hard now. Where has the work gone from our ancestors? We shouldn't have to pay mortgages off now. They should have been paid off years ago. The houses should have been passed down to us. I mean, I know this is to do with inflation and the corrupt monetary supply. But if you understand, and certainly that's what one of the things that the book brings home is, the fact that how hard these people did work. They worked incredibly hard, backbreakingly hard, really the almost unimaginable, certainly the coal miners and people like that that he was talking to in Wigan and places like that. The cotton mills as well, hellish, yeah? So things have not changed, and it's very difficult to get this through to people, and certainly a lot of people in the mind-body-spirit movement, so in the alternative movement, and they're interested in, I don't know what it is, Reiki, or they're interested in fairies and unicorns and all this kind of thing, yeah? What they don't realise is these movements have come and gone in the past. I mean, to me, the hippies were far more vibrant and far more on it, you know, in terms of trying to challenge the corporations than anything is now. You know, these students now pale in comparison compared to what was going on in the 60s and the 70s and that kind of thing. If anything, things have gone backwards. People are trying to fit in with the system even more now than they were. You know, nothing has changed. No spiritual movement has changed anything. This 2012, in my opinion, is a load of absolute nonsense. And people have got to wake up to that fact and just accept it, that things haven't changed. We were born into slavery. We were born into the corporate system that's been there for at least 1,000 years that we know about. Nothing has changed since that time. It's all just surface reflection. And that's one thing I tried to put across. And the example that I'll give you, that I use in the documentary that people can see, is I go to a mill in Preston. Now, Preston and wider Lancashire is famous for its cotton industry. It's also famous for the terrible conditions that people used to work in. That mill in Preston, Talkath Mill in Preston, is now a call centre run by a telecommunications centre. What is the difference? Obviously, there's certain technical differences between the work that people did in a mill and the work that people did in a call centre, but it's exactly the same environment. In fact, if anything, I'd probably want to work in a mill more than I'd want to work in a call centre, to be quite honest with you, yeah? But nothing's changed. It's a mill now, it's a call centre now.
What we're effectively saying is that people might have access to central heating, they might have access to fridges, they might have access to inside toilets and bathrooms, but essentially they're doing possibly even less satisfying, less productive work than they were doing before. And also that the people have become, if you like, more pliant, more compliant, because then people were talking amongst themselves, they were able to move things forward. But like you said about the students, people are less likely to complain now than they were then.
Yeah, I mean, one other example I'll give is in terms of back then, and one thing I do point out in the documentary is one thing that people had, and they had it very, very strongly, and it seems to be one thing that we are increasingly losing, and that is this strong sense of community. People had back then in the 1930s, and Orwell describes it. Orwell describes going into people's homes. It describes the warmth of the community. It describes how people can't fall through the net in those kind of communities. So even though the communities were poor and they were struggling, just as they are now, it was very difficult to kind of completely fall through the net because you had a strong support network around you. you had a strong family network around you, which, although people might be strong to the, you know, close with their immediate families nowadays, so the mom, the dad, the brothers, sister, etc., maybe the first cousins, the extended family, due to this this thing we call social mobility, which is a euphemism for people kind of just breaking up the family ties, people don't have that anymore, and they don't have the sense of community where they know the people on the street or they know the people in the local community. And that's a result of slum clearances. This is one thing I point out in the documentary. It's the result of slum clearances. Liverpool's a good example of this, where people, where massive numbers of people were cleared out of the slums. They were moved out to the outskirts of the city, or right out to the outskirts of Merseyside, really, into these new estate towns. And it was all, well, it was the, you know, it's difficult to say it was a deliberate attempt, but it was certainly an attempt to move people away from areas that were commercially valuable, you know, so they could build shops and retail units and things, move them out into the suburbs, and it destroyed the community. So really, what matters in our life? You know, does it matter having, you know, these big houses and, you know, the, all these fancy gadgets like iPhones and, you know, computers, laptops, whatever it is? Or does it matter, you know, the human relationships that we have with each other, which, you know, really we've we're losing out on? And it's a poor reflection when people are on these networks. I'm seeing, you know, like looking in front of me now, Skype things and all this sort of stuff. It's really, I don't think anyway, not the same as that. And maybe that's necessary now because people have gone in their own different ways. And I'm not saying that things haven't improved. There's a lot of great developments, and we shouldn't be knocking these kind of technological developments. We should be celebrating them. You know, I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. But what I'm saying is that what we've got to realize is that the things at the heart of the matter haven't changed. Yeah, these things are good. Yeah, they help us and everything. But really, we don't want to lose the things that really matter in our lives, and that's a sense of community. But overall, the point is that things really haven't changed. Things really haven't changed that much. If anything, things are getting worse. And Orwell points this out with the destruction of local businesses, you know, local shops closing down, this kind of thing. And shops, again, that held the local community together, people you could rely on, people that you knew, people that you enjoyed dealing with. All those things have gone now, and we're living increasingly in a corporate system. And yeah, I believe that people are. I've just, you know, I'm at university at the moment, and people, it seems to me, are increasingly at university for the second time, by the way. So when I was talking about before about you used to give your parents' address out, I went to university, had a career for 10 years, and I decided to go back to university. But yeah, it seems ever more that people are wanting to comply with the corporate structure. I'll give you an example. At university now, they don't call it your student card anymore. It's not called your student card. They actually call it, believe it or not, your corporate card.
Is that right?
That's
they're
right.
Actually doing that.
They actually call it the corporate card. And I was shocked when I went back.
That's
like,
so
I'm
in
serious.
Your, that's really in your face, isn't it? That's really, really obvious.
And the other thing is, I mean, the buzzword at university at the moment is employability. Employability, right? Everywhere, employability. What are you doing for your employability today?
And universities, of course, used to be centres of research. That was the idea, was that you got your brightest minds in there to start moving things forward and to actually do the top-level work that was going to be of benefit to other people, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And instead, what we've got, as you show in your documentary, is that as the mills and stuff close, as we produce less and less, there's less and less money in the local economy, and that means that suppliers have to shut down. And that means that there's fewer people with less money to shop in the shops, leading to exactly what you're describing.
Nick, the only thing I've learned at university, and after 3 years of being there, the only thing that I have learned and the only thing they have taught me is one thing. I can sum it up in one word, and that is obey. That is it. Obey.
Obey, comply.
Yeah, that's it. It's just one thing. Obey. And whether it's obey these instructions and you'll pass your essay, whether it's obey these instructions and we'll give you a degree, no matter what it is obey. You don't question anything. So in other words, if I want to question, why is it called a corporate card? It used to be called a student card the first time I was at university. It used to be called a student card. Now it's called a corporate card. You know, and the university now, most of it is funded, as many people are aware, by corporations. You've got, you know, McDonald's sponsoring degrees. You know, Walt Disney have got their own university, all this kind of thing. It's very disheartening, really. And people, you know, really what I'm saying is people just need to wake up to this fact and stop getting distracted. Everything else other than the fact that we are enslaved is a distraction, you know, and we have to deal with it. We have to deal with this enslavement. And this is what we're going to be talking about later in the show, is some of the solutions. But in the meantime, we have to deal with these distractions. And, you know, we've got things like sports at the moment that are just absolutely crazy. I was supposed to be going to Liverpool on Saturday just to see somebody. And she said, there's no point in coming down. I said, why? She said, because the Grand Nationals are, fair enough, the Grand National, and Everton and Liverpool are playing, it'd be chaos. Sport is such a big, you know, this big, huge thing. What about people's communities? These people are rabbling on about Liverpool, you know, Everton. I don't mind, you know, watching a football match now and again. Communities are falling apart in Liverpool.
In fact, it's actually all events, isn't it? Because we've seen a falling away of music from smaller venues. In fact, I know it's making a bit of a comeback, but we now only got the choice of going and seeing bands in massive venues.
Yeah.
So it's not just the sports; it's everything. So. It's generally a matter of scale, isn't it? The corporation, as you so rightly put it, the large scale item where all the money can be made, where it can cost us a ridiculous amount of money even to go to a football match or a gig. So the whole thing is becoming corporatized, and once again, of course, that removes us from smaller events where we can actually talk to people, because you're in a massive crowd, your adrenaline's high at either a gig or at a football match, and there isn't the will to communicate with the people who are around you. It's tribal.
I think people need to take a step back from these things and really, really look at the fact that if we continue as we're continuing, we're heading in a very, very... We're making things very difficult for ourselves. We've got to basically realise that we've been enslaved, we've got to look at the system, and people need to really, really focus on that. I'm pleased to say that it is happening to a certain extent. And if I can talk about another inspiration for the documentary, and I've been involved with a group called New Horizons, which I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with, and I know you've spoken yourself there, Nick, on many different occasions. And maybe we can put the website on the blog or the link or whatever. And New Horizons is a group. www.newhorizonsstannes.com. If people can't get on the website or whatever, but it's a group that's been going for 20 years. It basically has a different speaker every week, every Monday night, which is quite a feat when you think it's been going for that long, and they've managed to put a speaker on every week for 20-odd years, you know. And they're basically talking about a variety of different subjects. Some of it is mind, body, spirit, so, you know, alternative healing, that kind of thing. It's not really my topic, but a lot of them are more sort of relevant, what's going on in people's lives, more about the system, basically, you know, like we've said, the financial system, the legal system, the social system, that kind of thing. So some great speakers that I saw over the years that were inspiring to me, people like Brian Gerrish, Andrew Johnson, Ian R. Crane, people like that, really trying to wake people up about what's going on. I mean, the group's changed particularly over the last 5 years since James Stewart took it over, to really make it more of the factual-based stuff, more of the real-life stuff, more of the high-impact stuff. And it's been an absolutely great group. And then perhaps even more recently than that, we've had the so-called Freedom Movement or the Free Man Movement, which the documentary focused on quite heavily. Not necessarily that I wanted to make a documentary about that. I think it'd be a great subject, and if someone did make a documentary about that, I think it'd be fantastic if they just wanted to focus on the so-called Freedom Movement. Mine was more of a broader perspective, but you know, hopefully your viewers or listeners are familiar with people like John Harris, Abdul Nur, Naveed Masood, Darren Dioji, those kind of people that really start getting people thinking about the law, getting people thinking about the corporate structure, how the fact, you know, they have been enslaved. We're paying to be enslaved. We're paying our enslavers to make it worse for us every time we pay our taxes, every time we pay our utility bills, every time we give any of our energy to the system, and we're not giving our energy to bringing the system down. The system isn't working for us. Not only is it not working, it's deliberately failing us.
And of course, the work we're all doing on TNS, the work you're doing on the system documentary, the work New Horizons are doing, and we've all realised, haven't we, that there's an ever-increasing number of people who are awake, but there's also a lot of people who don't know that anything's wrong, and they don't know. And I know New Horizons sometimes gets up to 140, 150 people.
Yes.
And there's a huge variety in there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, no, it's an absolutely huge variety. I mean, there is a New Horizons down the road at Preston. They're more on the mind-body-spirit side of things. But we have people on alternative health. We have people on, you know, so like oxygen, things like that. We have, so in other words, you know, ozone and that sort of stuff. There's a guy talking this Monday coming up about herbs, herbal medicine, that kind of thing. But then the next week we'll have someone like Ian R. Crane. Well, actually, the next week after that, we do have Ian R. Crane on. And he's talking about the fact that we're betraying our children. If we support this system for a minute longer, if we don't do something about the system, or if the listeners aren't prepared to do something about the system now, tonight, here, then it's going to continue and you're going to pass it on to your children. And, you know, I've had many people, these so-called baby boomers, that have turned around and said sorry to me when they've realised about all this stuff. The fact that they didn't go against it more, the fact that they didn't speak out, the fact that they weren't able to document their own history. And that's why it's important that more people get out there with cameras and do, you know, like yourself, interviewing people all the time and getting these messages out. We're going to be appearing later on, you know, on the TV on a show that really goes out to a hell of a lot of people, and thank God it does, and thank God these things are happening. One of the other inspirations is because it's not a fringe movement anymore. You know, people talk, oh, what is the system? The system is what happens when you walk outside your door, when you look outside your window. The other big inspiration for me was walking around Preston and seeing it falling apart. You know,
that's what really comes across at the very beginning.
I was made redundant. You know, I had a good job and everything. I was living a nice life in the system. I was made redundant. But then I started, it wasn't just me made redundant. I started noticing the local post offices closing, the local banks closing, you know, the bank that I used. So many pubs in Preston closed. So many. It was unbelievable. You know, in quite a short space of time, really.
Yeah.
One after another was closing. You know, the Spindlemaker's Arms was closing, the Tanner's Arms was closing. You think, oh, well, God,
they've all got
ones.
Traders' names, haven't they? In the days, there would probably be enough tanners to fill a whole pub, and now we haven't got a single
Spindlemakers.
One.
Spindlemaker's. Yeah, there's no Spindlemaker's anymore.
People don't even know what a spindle is, probably.
Yeah, so all these different pubs were closing. You even had churches. I'm not a big fan of churches, don't get me wrong, but you know, the fact that they were a meeting ground, at least for people, you know, so they were closing.
That's actually going to turn out to be quite an important point, because I know that in Greece, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, there's it's around the schools and the churches that people are meeting.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
That's where the food's being handed out. That's where people are working on solutions. So, you know, Lou, we don't know, this is another point, isn't it? We don't know what we're losing now that's going to turn out, might have turned out to be important to us in the future.
Well, yeah, I mean, an interesting point there is I spent some time on a social housing project, or, you know, we would say council estate in this country, and you know, a few of the people didn't want to be interviewed because of various reasons. But two of the people that I did speak to, I didn't use the interviews in the end, because you've got to remember, when you do a documentary, you do a lot more interviews than you actually end up using, because, I mean, I've edited down as much as I can. It's still 7 hours long. But they were actually operating, because alcohol's so expensive in the pub and it's so cheap in the supermarket. It's cheaper than water in the supermarket. If you go into a pub, I mean, I drink, you know, Guinness, it's over £3 a pint now. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how people can afford to go out and buy a round of drinks anymore. Amazing. But so, and they've started inviting people around to their house, and they bring their own beer, and they bring them some beer, sort of thing. And this is what's happening, really. I mean, it's like, but unfortunately, it's not in any kind of structured way. It's in an ad hoc way, and but it's great that people are finding ways around that. But when you go onto these places, these council estates and everything, and you know, people are struggling. People are genuinely struggling. There's a lot of substance abuse, there's a lot of alcoholism, people have given up all hope of ever really getting any kind of meaningful employment. And if we can just stick on that, the meaningful employment, I'll give you an analogy where someone walks along and says to a guy, what are you doing? And he says, oh, I'm just laying these pavings. Goes along to another guy, says, what are you doing? He says, I'm building a cathedral. Now, just imagine the difference. Yeah. Meaningful work. People have lost the meaningful work, and with that they've lost a lot of hope. They've given up hope of ever getting a job, some of these people, especially in the Northwest. I don't know where the bulk of your listeners are listening from, but the Northwest of England, it was one of the richest places. You know, places like Burnley and Nelson were extremely wealthy. There was a lot of wealth there. Where's all the wealth gone? Where is all the wealth that was generated, all the work our ancestors did? It's just disappeared.
I guess it's because you can't make as much money. You can't really make money out of something when you're not making anything. If you're making all your money out of financial services, out of call centres, there isn't anything physically coming out. And so the money goes down and, as we say, results in the collapse of everything underneath it. And, of course, it's some of the gainful employment used to be in farming and fishing. Probably more gainful than anything else, because you're actually then turning food. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we were more or less self-sufficient in food and fish, and now it's not there anymore.
Yeah, well, I look at the, I take a shot just in Lytham. There's a small fishing industry, thank God, still going, and it supplies a local shop, which is amazing. It's very heartening to see that. And a lot of the cockles that are collected in that area, unfortunately, actually, most of the cockles that are collected in the area are shipped out to France and Belgium. I mean, that's by the by. It would be better to keep them in the local area. But, yeah, the fishing industry has been decimated. Agriculture's gone. The point that I make, though, is that these new industries, I was working in financial services. That was before I knew about the system and all that. But I didn't find anything when I worked in it. But, you know, even those jobs are going now. So people, you know, what the long-term solution is, I don't know. The thing that people have to realise is the corporation doesn't care. No, it doesn't care.
Like one of your interviewees says, I think she was a student, and she describes it as dominating, masculine, and not harmonious, having to work like a machine 9 hours a day to earn the minimum wage.
Well, this you can speak about Nikki specifically. I mean, you know, I know her personally. She's was at university at the same time as me. She, you know, went through this whole thing, £20,000 in debt. She gets a degree. And then she looks around, the only jobs, she lives in Great Harwood, which is sort of more East Lancashire, the only jobs that are available are packing plastic forks in a factory. You know, it's the only, you know, what job can you get? Because she was quite desperate at the time because her parents, they were struggling, and they didn't have room for all the family in the house, a lot of people in this situation. She had to sort of, thankfully she's managed to move in with her grandmother now, but she was really in a situation where, you know, she was needing somewhere to live, and those are the kind of jobs. And the point that she's making is that it's machine-like, and that's what we're getting to. And McDonald's is another thing. There's no meaningful kind of end to it. More and more people are working for these places that they hate the places. Mm. They hate the jobs. They hate the places. Imagine that negative energy that's generated.
Yeah, and they didn't do all that work, all that studying, all that trying to make themselves different from everybody else just to have to stay at home with mum, did they?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, this you know, from the lies that we've been sold over the years, and for the terrible, heinous crimes this country has committed against other people, you know, you think, which is terrible, and I totally disagree with that, but the fact that we've had to put up with that, and then we've got nothing back from it at all. It's been a complete and utter lie. We've been lied to, well, for God knows how many thousands of years, but we've certainly been lied to for the last 1,000 years that engaging in this corporation is going to do anything for us. There might be a short-term benefit that you can eat, but to be honest, sometimes I think I'd rather die on the streets than actually work for this monster, because all you're doing is committing other people. There's a great quote, I can't remember, the Jefferson or something, was it? It's saying the corporation, all the choice it gives you is to make the rivets for the chains of your fellow man, something like that. That's the only option we've been given, to make the rivets for the chains to enslave our fellow men.
And of course, it's inevitably, I mean, for financial reasons, which I'm sure we'll get into, but it's inevitably leading to a sticky end, because as another of your interviewees said, he describes the system as basically designed to dig it up and then either burn it or wear it out. That basically it's a meat grinder.
Yes.
It is designed as fast as possible to work our way through the resource. And that means inevitably that it's going to crash. And the first signs of those crashes are going to happen down at the bottom. Our failure is inevitable because the system is designed to fail.
It's a house of cards. Yeah, it's a house of cards. When you any debt-based system, we've seen this in the past, any social system that is going the way our social system is going. And when I went into Manchester the other day, and you know, it was like something from a weird sci-fi movie. Some of the people, I'm all into freedom and expression and all that sort of stuff, but to me, you know, the society is falling apart. There's got to be some kind of common unity. I don't really like using that word because it sounds a bit like common purpose, doesn't it? But community, common unity. Community. It's got to be some kind of community spirit and something that binds people together in certain ways. We can still express ourselves, we can still have artistry and creativity, which I absolutely love, I absolutely love those things, and you know, I'll fight to the death to support those things. But at the same time, we've got to have some kind of connection with the other people that we're living in the community with. We've got to find some way of doing that, or we've got to go and set up new communities, which maybe we'll get into later. But just going back to the point of that, the system is exactly that. It's dragging things out of the ground, and it's burning them up and wearing them out as fast as possible. And the analogy that's then taken from that on a for the social system or on a human level is that it is a giant meat grinder, and we are the ones in that meat grinder. We've always been the ones in that meat grinder. Until we wake up to that fact, nothing is going to change. We are the ones being ground up by this system. We've got to stop. People just need to totally withdraw from that system, because that is what it is a giant meat grinder, and it never is ever satisfied.
And the main weapon, of course, that's being used is finance, isn't it? It's money, because what we're actually seeing is that the work is becoming more and more finite, so the amount of money in the system, or the amount of nominal money, supposed money in the system, is declining, and yet the payback, the amount of stuff we're expected to pay, is consistently growing exponentially. So there's less and less of it around, and more of it to pay. And it's all going to them, to the paymasters, and none of it
well,
to us.
Well, a great point that Michael Hallam makes is that after the Second World War, which is the biggest war ever in history at the time, you know, there's nothing can compare to it. Well, it's since forever, it's the biggest war that's ever been, you know, in terms of the loss of life and the horrendous kind of suffering that especially the Russian people and certainly the German people had to go through was, you know, absolutely incredible, off the scale. And a lot of that you don't even hear about, especially the stuff that went on in Russia. It's very hazy, you know, we don't know exactly what happened, but massive swathes of population were moved, they died of starvation, they died of disease, some of them were just massacred. I mean, it's absolutely, you know, we're not here to talk about that, but it's a terrible, terrible thing, yeah?
But it's happening again, isn't it? I mean, I've just heard that what's happening in Greece at the moment is they've got a million immigrants, shall we call them, from places like Afghanistan, Pakistan and Turkey, I think it is. They've been there for a long time, but now that the Greek government is imposing austerity, or the EU, whoever it is imposing austerity measures, there's fewer places in the hospitals, there isn't enough medicine, there aren't enough houses, or people can't stay in their houses. And what they're doing is they're turning around and blaming the results of this economic austerity on these immigrants, on these poor, destitute people. And what they're doing now is they are building prisoner camps, effectively concentration camps. They're having security sweeps through, and they're putting these people behind bars. They're literally enclosing them. And because the Greek people are being kept, you know, too busy, you know, with the increasing electricity prices, increasing taxes, people dying on the streets, they don't mind. They haven't got time to come up with a compassionate response. And then there's always this thought, exactly as in Germany, exactly as what you were referring to, this is happening to somebody else.
Well, the point I was going to make, the point I was leading on to from there was after the Second World War, which had all these terrible things and people were decimated, after that, it was possible, and Michael Hallam makes this point, that just a male in the family could go out to work. Now, obviously, if women want to go to work, that's fine. They can, you know, nowadays that's great that what's happened, you know, they're able to do that. But it's not even about that, though. And I think there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of people missing the point, that it's not a case of if you want to do it or you don't want to do it, because realistically, they could have done it back then in a lot of ways. You have to do it now. You can't make an honest living anymore. You can't do it. You know, can you imagine just one guy going out and having five children now? Well, I look back, my grandparents, they had five kids, and they were all brought up well, they were all well fed. Only my grandfather worked. My grandmother never worked. She never went out to work. She was a housewife.
I mean,
you know, and they could afford to do that, though, and five kids. Could you afford to bring five kids now? And one, and my grandfather worked in a dye works. He didn't have a very good job, you know, and that was the Yorkshire family. The people in Lancashire, they all worked in the mills, obviously. But it was only really the man that went out to work, and they could bring a family of five. Well, you can't even do that now.
That's the point, isn't it? Is that both people and sometimes the children in a house have to work in order to pay the mortgage and the bills and all of that.
Yeah, things are getting worse. Things are not getting any better. They're getting worse. Absolutely. I mean, you know, this idea that, but then, you know, we look back and say, well, people were poorer then. But if you can bring five children up and you can't do it now, then who's poorer? You know, people can't afford to have kids now.
No, indeed. And I mean, the only reason they can, to a certain extent, is because the state, the corporation, is also funding people to breed. Because otherwise they would stop. Under these current circumstances, inevitably that kind of thing would stop as well, which means that they lose their individual revenue streams. Because as we know, each individual entity that's born is its own little corporation, its own little revenue stream, and it's going to give birth to more little revenue streams. So they do not want, above all, this kind of huge inconvenience and suffering that we're undergoing to stop us from breeding. They need the children. But it's of course, it's not just a matter of money, is it? It's the politics as well.
Well, some people disagree with that because they say they want population reduction, you know. So I mean, there is that side of it as well. I think we've got to remember that they are trying to reduce the population. They do seem to be, you know, people are being squeezed from every angle. I sometimes wonder how people keep going in their daily lives. You know, these people that work for the corporations, how do they manage to kind of, you know, why don't they just give up? You know, sometimes it's amazing to me that people manage to hold it together when they've got children. They've got, you know, who works 9 to 5 anymore if you have an office job? I can remember when I had an office job, I never used to work 9 to 5. I was in at 7:30. I had to, because, you know, we started at 8, but never left before 5 though.
No, it's true. It's always been a bit like that, hasn't it?
Yeah, you know.
It has.
And yet all these things in the 70s and all these kind of promises, if you watch Tomorrow's World, you remember that programme and all these kind of things, yeah? There were promises, more and more leisure time, you know, we'd have all these machines to do extra things for us. Far from doing extra things for us, when we've got these iPhones and everything, it's more of a headache. You've got emails to respond to now, text messages and everything.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, I suppose you could say, well, washing machines, fair enough and everything, but they only last for a few minutes before they break. If you want to get a washing machine repaired now, there's no point, you know, you may as well get a new one. I mean, some things have improved. I'm not saying they haven't improved. What I'm saying is that these are minor superficial things. Really, our basic situation has not changed from the 1930s, and you could probably go back a lot further before it has changed. And the system relies on us believing, I think it was Weston A. Price, a quote from him, this, that the lives of our ancestors were nasty, brutish and short. But the further you go back, actually, and the sort of things, you know, you talk about in some of your history talks, it doesn't seem that way. It seems they had a richer spiritual heritage. It seemed they had closer communities. It seemed they knew more about the natural environment. It seemed they were able to build more. It seemed they knew more about sacred geometry. A lot of the sacred sites are all lined up in sacred geometry. Yeah.
In fact, one of your interviewees, the lady that you spoke to in the so-called social housing, she seemed to remember from the so-called slums that were cleared. She was remembering community. She was remembering concerts. She was remembering all sorts of things. She wasn't remembering grinding poverty. She wasn't remembering having no heating. She wasn't remembering having an outside loo. She was wanting to talk, wasn't she, about the old times?
I just have to mention here, unfortunately, because I thought that was one of the best interviews. It lasted about 3 hours, that interview, but I had to really cut it down to just a few seconds, really. But unfortunately, the family of the lady in question asked me to remove it, so it's actually no longer in the documentary. There were a couple of instances where, after doing the documentary, I had to remove it because it was, especially the second half, where I'm supporting Mike Dobson and things like that, it was maybe too controversial for some people, and it did go a bit too far for... unfortunately, because really the people that I've been accused of preaching to the converted and all this kind of thing, because the people that I'd really, really like to watch this documentary, the people that I made this documentary for a specific person in mind, my friend's stepdad, who was really struggling at the time, but of course, unfortunately, he's too busy watching, as I say in the documentary, he's too busy watching singing and dancing competitions on his television, you know, karaoke singing, to actually sit down and watch something that... that's actually going to, you know, challenge the system. And that's the shame with people, you know, they are so busy and distracted, or they're either watching sports or soap operas or whatever, that they're not able to watch it. But unfortunately, yeah, that lady you mentioned, she's been removed, unfortunately. I wish she could have stayed in.
Yeah.
But the point she's making is that she didn't remember. Most people, when you speak to them, actually, most older people, when you speak to them, they tell them the stories. They don't mention outside toilets. They might say, oh, yeah, it was a bit cold in the winter or whatever, but you can get by with an outside toilet. It's not a massive inconvenience. Which would you rather have? An amazing community and brilliant adventures with the community and all this love and affection and support in the community, and an outside toilet? Or would you have what we've got now, where no one knows the neighbours, you know, no one knows anything about the community, and an inside toilet?
And of course, in those days as well, many people had a few chickens in their backyard. I believe it was also more or less habitual to have a pig, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
So yeah. You had your own kind of emergency resource. You didn't have to eat it all yourself. You could barter with it.
Mm.
And there's nothing left to barter with, because it's all coming with a limited shelf life out the supermarket.
If you work in a call centre as well, what sort of skills have you got? Apart from answering a phone, and when all the, you know, if we believe that the system's going to collapse, which a lot of people in the documentary are saying, and this is another key theme that we'll maybe get into later, but yeah, what have you got? You've got nothing. The skills are being removed from people, and people are doing these kind of mono jobs as well, where they're just very repetitive, or they're working in retail, you know, in retail shops. Well, that's all going to dry up, isn't it? The amount of shops I show in Preston that are boarded up, the amount of, the officers, this is another thing I'm talking to the builders, the skilled craftsmen. who the bedrock of any local economy, are absolutely struggling at the moment. And if they're struggling, then there's, I don't know what hope there is for anybody else, because they're the ones that traditionally would have been spending the money as well.
And I was particularly amazed by that. I mean, their basic points are that the price of raw materials are going up, the price of fuel's going up, the price of tools, not only is the price of tools going up, but the tools will die within a year because of built-in obsolescence. There's taxes are going up, and yet the demand for repairs is going down because people they've got other things to think about. The demand for extensions, improvements, the value of savings is going down, the value of pensions is going down, or more likely disappearing altogether. And wages, I mean, the minimum wage, I was earning that 15, 20 years ago. And there you've got, on your documentary, you have a builder of all people, saying he's trying to find something else to do. Now, if building homes for people and, say, burying people are two things that you can't actually make a living out of, then it shows you how close to the bottom we are.
Yeah. I mean, it just seemed we're incredibly close to the bottom. I mean, the only person that I did speak to that was, because obviously I try to find, I always try and balance it out and everything and try and find people from different walks of life, was a guy that had opened a barber shop. And because he's doing these sort of fancy cuts, you know, like people want different shapes and everything in the hair sometimes, all that sort of stuff. If they have short hair, I'm sure people understand what I mean by that. He's doing quite well at the moment, and it is working. But it's quite funny, because when you look at the shop from the outside, two shops on the other side of him are boarded up, the shop on the other side is boarded up. And one of the reasons he's doing really well is because the rent is so cheap. I don't think it gets mentioned in the documentary. Maybe we should make more of a point of that. But you can get a shop now in Preston for really, really cheap money, because there are so many shops boarded up. And I'll go back to the north of England. How did this come about? I just walked about the streets in the town that I was living, and just opened my eyes. I'm not from Preston originally, but I've, you know, lived there a while and consider it an adopted hometown now. You know, it's amazing how many of these places are boarded up. It's amazing, you know, all the mills are derelict, or they've been turned into flats. Yeah, what hope is there for people? I mean, I didn't have any problem getting cutaways at all. You just walk out, there's boarded shops, boarded offices. You know, my office that I worked in is actually still empty. And I can't remember, years ago it was, but a number of years ago now, you know, it's still empty. No one's taking it over.
I was amazed by the number of you know, empty shops in a row on the vid, and especially the huge amount of housing stock,
especially in Liverpool. Liverpool is amazing. If you go to Liverpool, the other thing was around what really got to me, and I do show a shot of this in the documentary. You've got this amazing stadium, you know, Anfield Stadium. I am actually a Liverpool fan, so, you know, in one way, you know, I don't mind the football. But having said that, it annoys me when these idiots are getting paid, you know, what was it, 35 million for Andy Carroll or whatever they paid for him. Yeah, I mean, 35 million. What could have that done for the local community? Amazing. You've got this amazing stadium, and then around it you've just got basically a slum where the people, you know, are sort of almost dying in the streets, not far off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the houses are boarded up. They're going to clear them out.
Yeah,
it's going to clear them. They're all going to get moved out to Kirby, which is just a big council estate on the edge of Liverpool. It's got all sorts of, you know, and I know this because I know people that work there. My sister's actually, she goes round and round. She's like an occupational therapist. She meets a lot of these people. The amount of substance abuse is absolutely overwhelming in these places.
Because it's made cheap and available.
Possibly. We don't get into the whole drugs thing at the moment. But, I mean, a lot of people say, you know, the same people that are in control of the corporation. It's like you were saying, the way they make the money, porn and drugs and, yeah, and this kind of thing. It seems to be the two industries.
But it is a standard approach, though. A friend of mine did a modern languages degree, which meant that she had to spend a year in Russia, because she did, I think, Russian and French. And she said that this was before the Iron Curtain came down, so things were really impoverished there. She said if you saw a queue, you'd join it. You didn't know what was at the front of the queue, but if there was a queue, it meant there was something worth happening. It might just be a wizened apple or something like that you get. But one of the two things she said that were really plentiful were vodka and champagne, alcohol, two things you could get, which keep the people, you know, incompetent, I guess. So again, we can see that it's a kind of common approach. It might be vodka and champagne in one place, but it's going to be a crisp bag with some glue in it somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's well, it's interesting to note actually around the same area where all the houses bought up, there's a liquor shop on every corner. Just about, you know, Booze Brothers. In fact, this is coming up in the next episode, this, where I talk about nutrition. I know it's not the most exciting subject for everybody, but it's a still really, really important subject that people need to look into, nutrition. And I talk about the alcohol situation, where you've got, I mean, and I've got quite a few shots actually in the can at the moment of different shops with the word booze in the title. So you've got Booze Busters, Booze Brothers, Boozy Rouge, there's one of the local shops, Booze Express. You know, how many different sort of shops can you get with the word? Go out in your own local community, I'd say to the listeners, and just look how many different shops have got booze in the title, and how many newsagents you've got, yeah, selling alcohol for incredibly, incredibly cheap prices when all the pubs are closing down because it's too expensive. Yeah.
And that, of course, is another big change that I've seen as well, because when I first started working, as far as I know, there was only one petrol station in the whole nation selling alcohol. It was in Oxford, just down the road from us. And it was very difficult for people who were running places where people took vehicles to get alcohol. Now you've got alcohol in most of the petrol stations. Hmm. So again, we can see a kind of method that's been established elsewhere being well established here. And like you say, because it's cheap in the supermarkets, because it's cheap in these various other places, it means people can't go to the pub.
Hmm. You know? Yeah, and I've got nothing against people having a drink or anything like that, you know, if they want to have a drink.
Definitely not.
Yeah, absolutely not. No, I mean, I was having quite a big drink last night, you know. That's fine. It's great if you get together in a social situation, you like to have a drink, a smoke, chat and everything, you know. This is the other thing. I mean, we talk about, more freedom, all this sort of stuff. You know, just mentioned the smoking ban. I don't cover this in the documentary, but you know, the last person to ban smoking was Hitler, as most people are aware of. It's basically just an infringement on people's personal freedoms, which we're seeing more and more of. And but just going back to the nutrition thing, yeah, I think it's really important. When I went to Oldham, was it Oldham the other day? Yeah, Oldham, and I'm going to go back there to do some filming, because there's one particular street in Oldham. If anyone's listening from Oldham, you've got to check this street out, right? There's about 5 different fried chicken shops on it. You know, like you've got KFC and Southern Fried Chicken and Halal Fried Chicken and all this, right? There's about 5 different... How many fried chicken shops do you need, you know, on one street kind of thing, you know? And it's just this one street that's just filled with takeaways. And this is a really important thing. Orwell talks about this in the book, you see. And I'm trying to really... This is maybe for the other documentary that I'm hoping to do, which is really just an update on what he's done, rather than more... Because I've gone quite a lot into the Freeman stuff, and I didn't necessarily want to do that, but it was just what was there. You know, when we get to talk about solutions later, who were the people offering solutions? It just happened to be these people that were all interlinked. Somehow they were all interlinked. So, you know, people like... not necessarily agreeing with each other. So Ab Dunner might not agree with, you know, Roger Hayes or whatever, but they're still both talking at Truth Juice sort of thing, you know, so it's that kind of idea.
And they're, yeah, and they're meeting with each other, aren't they? We're all meeting with each other, yeah, to swap ideas.
At some point, they will be meeting, or hopefully they'll be coming on your kind of show, talking to you, that kind of thing, yeah? So, but when I was looking into the Orwell stuff, he talks about that. He's actually talking about tinned food and how bad tinned food, and I just thought, George, you'd be rolling. I think his name was Eric, really, wasn't it? But anyway, George, you'd be rolling in your grave now if you're worried about tin food back then. Tin food's good now for most of these kids. If they get tin food now, well, tin food's probably more healthy than what they're getting at McDonald's and Murder King and, you know, Kentucky Fried Carcass or whatever. Yeah, yeah? It's probably good compared to that. That's how bad things have got, you know. So,
and of course, the lack of nutrition is really important, because food is our actual medicine. If we have genuine, clean food that isn't being poisoned, that is nutritious and stuff, then it keeps us healthy, it keeps our minds alert. And food is one, the lack of proper food is one of the ways that they're managing to blind people to the blindingly obvious, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the quote is, I've written a few of these quotes down, and he talks about the food comes out, whatever you say, whatever you do through your life, it dies with you, but your nutrition lives on through the bones of your children.
Yeah.
How many birth defects are we seeing now? How many children with cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy? And I know that's a lot to do with the pollutants as well, which is a big issue, but it's also to do with the food, you know, people are having as them when they conceive and when they bring the children up. It's amazing now. You know, there's one in the shopping centre in Preston there, collecting for children's charities every time I go in there. Well, when I was at school, there were no kids in my class that had cancer. Mm. There just weren't any. I don't remember any kids getting cancer. Now you've got all these charities, kids with cancer. Mm. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Where's all that come from, yeah? It's to do with the nutrition. It's to do with what the kids are eating, yeah?
Yeah.
And that's why it's such an important issue. I don't cover it in this, for the next episode, yeah. That.
I think there's another aspect to do with food is that I come across many children as I wander around, and I've said for some time that if you can get their hands in the soil and get their feet on a stage, you'll have a much happier child. And I think of both of them are important to do with the stage is to do with confidence and to do with being able to put yourself in somebody else's position and be that person for a while, something that we don't otherwise really get a chance to do. But the food thing, children who won't eat all manner of things if you just put them in front of them from a shop, if they've actually had a hand in growing it out in the back garden or out on the allotment, then they'll try it and they'll like it. And again, it's just a way of opening up their mind to more things. And of course, now I'm aware that I've helped out a couple of school gardening clubs, and it's lovely to see them. They want to get out there, they want to see the bugs, they want to get dirty, they want to try things out. But even then, you've got to wonder, they're forced to wear gloves before they can handle soil, you know. So,
right, yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're yeah. out, they're kept, even when they're allowed out to do some of this stuff, they're actually kept out of touch with the elemental world in which they find. And again, that's a problem, because their immune system's compromised by the fact that they're not allowed to come in contact with things that it can play with.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing how some of these kids are going to, you know, come through with this kind of system that we're talking about. One of the great things to see in some of the youngest people that appeared in the documentary are actually Occupy people. I know Occupy's been criticised. Yeah, it's been infiltrated. The people at the top running it are very bad people. Supposedly a CIA operation from the start, some people are saying.
It's called Occupy, which is a strange word to choose.
Well, yeah, there's all sorts of things. And Darren Joji goes into this in the documentary about how really it could just be a complete sort of scam, and they were doing it as a social experiment, all these kind of things. I'd rather try and focus on the positives and what the positives were for me. When I went along to my local Occupy in Liverpool, there wasn't one in Preston, unfortunately, but there was one in Liverpool and a great bunch of people, and they were all people that were in their teens and 20s, you know, because we've got to remember, it seems like the system's brainwashing people more and more, so how these young people have got a chance, I don't know, but there were some great young people there, and it was almost like they were totally going against this kind of disinfectant life that a lot of children, disinfected life that a lot of children have brought up on. They were camping out on the streets, you know, they were eating with their hands and whatever they could get, really kind of roughing it, and it was great to see some of those, and hopefully, you know, that brings across from their point of view, forget the Occupy, what they're involved with, the fact that they're doing it, the fact that they're there, the fact that they're actually trying to bring the system down, and really, you know, came away from that with a great sense of hope.
I think that's really important, and I mean, they were labelled by others as anti-capitalists, whereas in fact what they're fundamentally looking at is anti-corruption. I mean, there might be several different voices there, which is, some people put that as a problem for Occupy, that, you know, it's disparate, it's not concentrated. But the people I spoke to, both in Occupy London and Occupy Bristol, they were proud of the various voices they had there, and they were proud of the fact that they were making a community out of it. Again, I think that's one of the important lessons out of Occupy, that these different voices were getting together, they were living together, they were trying to sort out problems, and under, you know, incredibly difficult circumstances, really.
Yeah.
I thought that some of the voices you found in the Occupy were brilliant.
Mm.
Brilliant, especially the young man who was going, this is it, this is your life,
yeah.
You know, this is
yeah,
it.
Yeah, he was a character, but I can tell you something as well, you know, it was coming up to winter as well in the northwest of England, there was torrential rain as I was at, you know, when I was doing the filming there, it was pouring down with rain. It's amazing how hardy they were and how they managed to sort of stay out in the cold and the wet and the wind as well, you know, out there in Liverpool, just on a sleeping on a concrete pavement basically. So I mean, yeah, good luck to them. In fact, I need to go back and visit them and sort of revisit some of those people and see what they're doing now. But yeah, that one particular guy was fantastic and very, very passionate, and I think that's what we need to do. We need to try and reach out to the young people. I've not really had much luck at university. People have said to me when I was making the documentary, I was going around and I said, oh, I bet your other students at university were interested in this project, weren't they, you know, when they've seen some of the stuff I've done. I was like, no, actually, no, they weren't. I couldn't get anyone to help me, is the truth. Couldn't get a single person to help me. And do you know why? It's because they're too busy applying for jobs as runners at the BBC. When I was doing media at university, anyone that even worked for the BBC was considered as a demigod. and I'm not exaggerating, it's like the Holy Grail getting a job for the BBC. These people used to come around and give talks and say nothing. They were just, most of them to me, they're idiots, you know, brainwashed idiots that are going on about the British Brainwashing Corporation. Yeah. So they come around and give a talk, not really say anything, and people would just be rapt, you know, wow, he's got a job for the BBC, sort of thing, you know, it's amazing. And applying for jobs are sort of on the Jonathan Ross show and things like that. They do anything, just they'll sweep the floor on a show like that. Yeah. But something that's actually real, something that's visceral, something that's challenging people, they're not interested. And the other thing is, you know, people say, oh, why don't you try and get funding, because I've got a bit of a problem now in that everything that I had was borrowed from the university. Unfortunately, for various reasons, they're not, I'm banned from borrowing anything from the university now. I'm not going to go into that.
Doing something useful with it, mate. Yeah. That's not popular.
Well, exactly. Yeah, I was actually wanting to do something useful with it. Basically, they want all the cameras for display purposes only. They don't want anyone to actually use them, you know. So I'm banned from the university. Well, I'm banned from speaking to the people, actually. But anyway, so I've just lost my thread because I'm so annoyed about that.
So, well, it means that you're, at the moment, you're being brought to a halt.
Well, yeah, I've been brought to a halt, and the reason is there's no funding for this. If you want to do a show about, and I've got nothing against these kind of people, but any kind of sexual kind of sort of a thing with you know, people that dress up in women's clothes or something like that, or there was one about sex phone lines the other day.
Voyeurism, really.
Yeah, sort of. What was it? Call lines. These people ring up for people talk about sex and things like that. So if you want to do anything like that, it seems there's any amount of funding you want. Mm. Any amount of funding. If you want to do, no one can question the system, and the reason is because there's no funding for it. Mm. There's no funding for me to go out and get a camera and to continue this. Even when I've pitched the idea to people, what they want, yeah, is exactly voyeurism, the Big Brother style thing. If I was following a couple of people round that, I don't know, you know, had sex in a particular way, or something was very unusual about their body, you know, they either were born with a huge penis or a very small penis.
Yeah.
You know, this is TV, this is what we want to promote, this is what we're going to fund. But if you're actually questioning something about the system, and you're really, really putting people on the line, forget it. You know, that's my experience anyway.
Well, I think it's quite clear. I don't really watch the telly anymore. I get to see it around at other people's places. Occasionally, I get to see a bit of it in the pub. I am aware, in the place where I most often see it, that relatives, shall we say, who used to get to watch some cheap quiz programs 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, are now watching them from 3 o'clock in the afternoon right the way through till 10 o'clock at night. Little bursts of news, as called, in between, but effectively, the telly is being used to dumb people down. And I look at it and I think, well, it could be used for exactly the other thing.
Hmm.
You know, we could be using it for vitalising people.
Well, when I'm obviously, because I'm interested in documentaries and making documentaries from an academic point of view, really, and literally because it's what I'm trying to do to get this message out, which is really the more important thing. That's been the key thing. I'm not bothered what anyone thinks of it, really. I'm just trying to give a platform, which we'll get into later, some of these people, you know, that are offering the solutions, etc. That's the point. But when I watch a mainstream documentary, not only is it voyeurism, but the other thing they do, and it's very insidious, this, and it's really, really harmful, is if I use the term ordinary people, I know I don't like that term, but people know what I mean, just ordinary working people, yeah, without any position of so-called authority in the system, they always try, and the way they do it's very subtle, but they always try and make them look like an idiot in some way, or make them look helpless, or make them look like they're a joke, or you know, somehow making fun of them, or sort of when you know the media and the camera angles, the sort of camera angles they use, the sort of lighting they use on them, it all adds to it. You know, my thing has been trying to make people look good, you know, try and give the people the voice and try and present them in the best light. Why would it be any different? Why would I want to do anything different? But the way they do it, you've got to look at it. As soon as you get an authority figure, you know, Ian Hislop did one recently when he was interviewing one of the Rothschilds and the chief rabbi and this kind of thing, yeah? As soon as you get anything different, they're presented in a completely different light. The reverence and the deference, wow, it's amazing. You know, this is a special person sort of thing.
Yeah.
They hold them up, the way they ask the questions, the tone of voice, lighting, the camera angles, it's totally different.
I actually saw, because I had no choice, I saw Our Diamond Queen, a documentary with Andrew Marr talking about the royal family, and I had to remove more or less every layer of clothing as I just boiled up inside. And in the end, I did have to run away. But it was exactly what you described. Endless, obsequious deference in the name of... I thought it was amazing. Trying to make them look human, would you believe?
Yeah.
What a strange phrase to be using.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's play a quick tune for the people, and then we'll get on to talking about some of the solutions that you came across, because there's plenty of those.
Yeah.
So thanks for it so far. Thanks to everybody who's out there listening, and for the fantastic feedback in the chat box. It's very generous of you. You're obviously enjoying the talk. I think that Grayling's doing a grand job. So I'll play you a quick tune, then we'll come back with a few solutions, folks. Welcome back. You're listening live to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com with Nick M and Grayling Barraclough. We've been talking a little bit about the problems, quite a lot actually, about the problems that are being raised by the society, or so-called society, in which we find ourselves. We now want to have a look at some of the solutions. We've got actually a lot more material than we're going to be able to get through in this show, so I would imagine that hopefully we'll be coming back for some more of it, because the best bits really are in the solutions. You can obviously find out about them by looking at the video itself. I'll post the link to part two in shortly. The link for part one went in a bit earlier. One of the chaps, Grayling, that particularly interested me was Michael Hallam, was that his name?
That's correct.
Talking about the Ethical Small Traders Association. He's trying to approach the problem on the ground and change the way people are trading.
Yeah, I mean, basically what I'd like to do now, if as time permits, is just run through from episode one through to episode one, part one, episode one, part two. People can, like you say, they can watch the video, follow the link. I'd advise you to, watch the video, obviously. If you've got any feedback, please just email me at broaderview.yt. You can send an email on YouTube. We can email directly on grayling.barraclough at Google Mail. That's fine. I'm quite happy for people to, any comments and suggestions. Like I say, the third episode's in waiting at the moment, just to when I can get hold of another camera. But anyway, if we start off with Michael Hallam, here's a guy who's really in his own local community, and this is really where it starts. In his own local town, set up something called the Ethical Small Traders Association. And he's basically recognised sort of 20-odd years ago that the system is unsustainable. He's recognised that people are being increasingly squeezed, that you can't lead a decent life anymore. And this is one of the reasons why more and more people are turning to criminality. And in a way, you can hardly blame them, because the criminal's at the top. The criminal's at the top, so you can hardly blame them for turning to criminality. And it's going to happen more and more that unless people actually make changes, unless people actually go out there and do something, the streets will become increasingly unsafe. But anyway, let's look at some of the solutions. We've looked enough at the problems now. So Michael Hallam, he set up things like time banks, trading we're using notes with a queen's head on at the moment. We don't need to do that. We can print our own currency, or we can just exchange, we can barter.
Time banks, of course, are a really excellent idea, because you're swapping your time for somebody else's.
Yeah.
And you might agree that the other person's worth twice as much as you, so you might give him him 2 hours for an hour of his time, say. But basically it gets rid of anything that's in between you and the person you're trading with, because it's just your time against his time. Who's going to tax that? Where's the value-added tax in that? Where's the income tax? There's nothing there, is there?
Well, that's one of the key things, is getting away from this situation where, the direct taxation is not on these things, and that's what the alternative trading network does. Now, Michael has really done a lot of work supporting small businesses. Not only that, he actually does talks as well. So if anyone listening is near a Truth Juice, look out for him at Truth Juice. He's got some great talks on the financial system. Look out for him at New Horizons. He's a great speaker. He doesn't always cover the Ethical Small Traders Association in his talks. It's more sort of general financial stuff.
Also, I can put in a punt for the fact that one of the earliest Dr. Rock podcasts is an interview with Mike. It's under Mike the Money Man.
Yeah, listen to him. Yeah, definitely. I definitely recommend him. And we need more people like this working in the community. He takes it from a community level, which is great. There's a lot of people trying to sort of, bring the whole system down and everything. He's working in his local community, and long may it continue. I'll certainly be paying him another visit in a future episode. So then if we move on to this kind of journey I had, because Michael Hallam's reasonably local to me, just up at Morecambe.
I just want to mention the fact that the things he emphasises are really quite important. Apart, he's very knowledgeable on the money system and why it is doing what it's doing. but his response to it is to emphasise collaboration, cooperation. He acknowledges that competition's important, but what he's trying to do is, again, get people to collaborate with each other, to work together, which is how we used to get things sorted out. And he emphasises, you know, it's communication, isn't it? And skills, yeah, knowledge, development.
Yeah. Well, he makes the very, very valid point that you know, if we take this kind of competition thing to a logical conclusion, it just involves us tearing each other apart. You know, we can collaborate on this. So if we were competing, I want to say something now, it just wouldn't work. Everything you've got in your home, every piece of equipment, is a result of collaboration.
Yeah, and competition inevitably ends up with one person having everything.
Yeah, and that's exactly what's happening. And, you know, these bankers, it's like a giant game of Monopoly, isn't it? That's what it turns into, a giant game of Monopoly, where the object to own absolutely everything. The object, you know, that Tesco has is to kill all the local shops, you know? That is the result of that. We've got to have collaboration, a bit of healthy competition, you know, within that sort of thing, you know, one small local shop. But really, how many butchers do you need in the local community? How many bakers do you need in the local community, really? You know, I mean, all those shops are going now anyway, sort of thing. But thankfully, people like Michael Hallam are there trying to support them and trying to get them to trade in new ways. He's another person that is saying the system's going to collapse. Isn't it amazing you've got all these people saying the system's going to collapse? You know, it's not like there's one lone nutcase out there saying it. And isn't it amazing that no one in the mainstream is? Or when they are in the mainstream, it's a big mistake like that. And Rossiani guy, you know, that was on the BBC, he's in the documentary as well. But it's like, oh, God, you know, it's a big mistake sort of thing.
And that was on the telly. That's a really amazing thing to watch. He's saying quite explicitly that it is going to collapse, and that it's going to collapse before the end of the year. And that the most important thing you can do is, if you've got any assets, protect them.
So moving on, because I realise time's an issue now. So I basically went on this journey. It was really basically in the northwest of England. Certainly this part was. I mean, the furthest down I went for the second part was Stoke-on-Trent. So went to Stoke-on-Trent, and I went to the British Constitution Group. And this is a fantastic group that it's amazing how many people they get there. And I think Brian Gerrish has done a lot of great work over the years, exposing common purpose, talking about a lot of the things that are going wrong, but telling, you know, giving people hope and talking about what people can do. Now, on to Roger Hayes. I realise Roger Hayes is not everyone's cup of tea. I realise he has got his critics and everything, but my God, at least he's trying. At least he's putting the work in. You've got to admire him for that. You've got to admire him for the amount of people that he's managed to gather together around this group, the amount of, you know, people he's got on his mailing list. This is important stuff, that we keep these people informed.
And by attracting them, because he's working, because he's in amongst all these other people, if anybody's attracted to any one of these individuals, like Roger Hayes or Darren Diogi or Michael Abernicia, you inevitably end up getting involved in the other people's material. So you don't follow just one school of thought.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. And that's why I wanted to show as wide a range of people as possible. And I try to get people from different perspectives. It's no good just focusing on one person. I've genuinely made an effort to go around at anyone that was offering solutions. Roger is offering a solution. The Lawful Bank, I know a lot of people, again, it's got its critics, thelawfulbank.com, but, you know, I'd check it out and give it a chance. People should give it a chance. A lot of people saying it's, you know, it's not going to work for one reason or another. Okay, that's fair enough, but he is trying. He's putting a solution on the table. He is one of the people that is recognising the current financial system is not working. Come on, let's put our minds together. We're intelligent people in this country. You know, we've got a bit of fortitude about us, haven't we? You know, can't we come up with a better solution than what we've got at the moment? Of course we can. Yeah.
Just going to put in the standard plug for Mike Montagna's mathematically perfected economy. At this stage, we do have a solution to the financial setup. But I agree with you, Grayling, that anybody who's actually addressing it to a certain extent, because you're basically making people realise that there is something else, which is a start, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't actually know that. I don't know where he lives. He probably doesn't live in the northwest of England. I may have covered him. But so anyway, onto some people that don't agree with Roger Hayes, even though I think he's doing a great job. And that's the North of England Economics Working Group. This is a group of people. I don't want to name particularly one individual in it. It'd be unfair to name one individual and say that he was the person running it. There's a lot of people involved. On the documentary, we see David Pidcock, he's involved with the Islamic Party of Great Britain, as well as many other ethical financial groups. Well worth checking out. I realise that not everyone's into the kind of Islamic side of it, but you know, this you know, they got it right about charging interest, didn't they? You know, they're the one group out there that are really against the interest charging, so they've got it right on that. And there's a few other people there. I mean, it was really great actually, because there's a few mainstream people there as well. There was a guy, come on, his name escapes me now, but there's a guy on the documentary you can look at, and he's from the Blackpool Trades Association. So this is mainstream people, you know, mainstream people looking at these alternatives, coming along. And the great thing that the North of England Economics Working Group have got is that link with the mainstream. They've been along to see the local MP. The MP has had, you know, he's welcomed them in. Well, I say welcomed. He has spoken to them. He's spoken to them at least. And they really are going for the mainstream. This is another economic solution. They are out there, and it's really important that the sort of people, you know, that are in this movement, you know, us, the listeners, all the people that we've got together, actually go along to these meetings. Even if they might not totally agree with a person or totally agree with the concept, it's still important to go along to try and support them and to find out, you know, what it is. Then we can generate the ideas together.
I think also, if you've got 75% of a common view with somebody, then we're going to have to swallow the 25%.
Yes,
you know, disagreement,
yes,
because you can work together with each other on the main body.
Well, there was a big disagreement actually at the meeting that I was at, and it was between David Pidcock and you know, some of the other members over a specific point, and it did get, you know, a bit heated at one point where there was this thing, it was almost like an intransigence about it. They couldn't accept the other person's view, but that's not a bad thing. And what was great actually about it, there were so many different, what I say on the documentary, there was, you know, all these different races, these people from the different parts of the community all coming together and actually talking to each other. Great. It was in a hotel in Blackpool. It was all day. The only distraction actually was David Boyle, unfortunately, which God knows what he was doing there. But anyway, him aside, it was, if anyone knows who he is, I don't know, but it was him aside, it was a great event. And yeah, people talking sense, basically,
and just getting people together, as we've mentioned, is progress. Because if we are being driven apart, we are being put in a position where we don't talk to each other.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Okay, so moving on to the next person after I'd been in Blackpool, because the thing is about the Blackpool group, there's nobody from that group, unfortunately, really. Having said that, though, I was on the edge with Naveed and David the other day, but they're not core members of the group. But there's no one really on that group sort of getting this message out, which is important, which is why, really, you've got to admire Roger Hayes in one point. He's getting out on the road. My God, is he putting the work in? Have you seen his touring schedule, his talking schedule? He's everywhere. It's amazing. You know, he's really, really putting the work in. You've got to admire him for that. Unfortunately, the group in Blackpool doesn't seem to be getting out, because it is really just the people of Blackpool and the local area trying to come up with, you know, financial solutions. So,
but they are getting mainstream people to pay attention to them.
Yes, in the local community. In the local community are. They're really going for the mainstream people in the local community. So Blackpool Trades Association, the MP for Blackpool. And that is very important, actually. And really, you'd be surprised how much power these groups have in the local community. At a local community level, how much they can influence when people get together. Suddenly the MP's got to listen to you then. If you're on your own, well, the MP can fob you off or whatever, but when there's quite a group of you together and you're gradually making these connections and you're meeting on a regular basis, that's the way we've got to do it. That's the way it's got to go forward. Okay, so talking about getting it out then, I then say they're not getting it out. And I mean, people can, you know, watch this in the video, but just to bring another guy up who's, at the time anyways, maybe he's sort of taken a bit of a step back now because of personal circumstances has meant that he's had to move abroad, but Abdul Nur, and he's another very controversial figure. A lot of people don't like him. He's upset a lot of people, and it's because of this.
I was very impressed. His was some of the content that I thought was extremely clear and undeniable.
Right,
you know, he's the gentleman, isn't he, who said that basically every 10 years they have to double the amount of credit just to be able to keep repaying the amount of debt that's already out there, and that's basically the engine for the trillions of dollars of debt or pounds of debt that we see.
Yeah,
he's well worth looking at him.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's got a lot of great information. I think he'd probably be a lot popular if he dropped this. You know, he's into the Islam and all this kind of stuff. Again, he'd probably be a bit more popular in the movement if he didn't have if he wasn't so into those kind of views. But again, you know, everyone's different. This is what I'm trying to show: a different amount of people, like you say, is coming out with a lot of great information. He explains it in a clear way. He explains the banking system, and the great quote, and I think I've got this on the trailer, is he's saying that it's not, they are trying, you know, these banksters, whatever you want to call them, they are trying to engineer this crash to their advantage. But it's not about, it's not that the crash isn't going to happen. It's going to happen. It's just that they're trying to engineer it to their advantage. It's not a case of will it happen, won't it happen. He's another person that's saying it's going to happen. And he's great on the corporate structure, actually. He talks about, you know, where the corporation, this is later in the documentary, where the corporation came from, how the corporate structure came about, and how it's so pervasive. The tentacles of the corporate structure, the vile tentacles of the corporate structure, reach into every aspect of our lives. Every single aspect. It's, unless you literally... I mean, you can't go anywhere because they own all the land. So if you wanted to get away from it, you know, what would you do? This is what we'll be talking about soon. But
and that was exactly the problem with Occupy, of course. The authorities and the church have seized all the land, which automatically puts Occupy on their doorstep. And because they've got all the land, they're the ones who must offer some remedy. And even though they're sympathetic to Occupy, they don't seem to recognise that.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, amazing, really. So he really went on a speaking tour trying to educate people on the corporate system and provide alternatives. And I show him basically going round to one group, New Horizons, which we've spoken about, and just giving his talk. It went down really well. It's a shame he couldn't continue with it. But for personal reasons, he had to, you know, he married. He ended up, to cut a long story short, I don't want to go into too much detail. Yeah. He got a Kuwaiti girl pregnant. If you get anyone pregnant over there and you don't marry him, you get your...
Right,
your tender bits chopped off. So he, you know, he had to get married and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So he had to ended up going away.
He looks happy enough with it.
Oh yeah, he's a happy, you know, family man and everything now. And I think one of the things you don't see on the documentary, but I did a bit of filming of one of his talks at New Horizons. At the end of the talks, he picks his little baby son up. I don't know how old the child was, probably just a few months old, really. Brought the child to the talk, and he, you know, presents the child to the camera and sort of says, "This is the future. This is what I'm doing this for. I'm doing it so this little man doesn't have to grow up as a slave."
And I think also that's where the solutions are, isn't it? With the next generation.
Yes.
The work we're doing is going to enable them.
This is why we're here talking today, yeah. This is why we're here talking today. And then finally in the second episode, I do want to give a, you know, big plug to, because I know he's done a lot of fantastic work, not just on the Freeman movement, but in other areas too. In fact, I say some of the work he's done in other areas is even more valuable than what he's talking about, the Freeman stuff, and that's Darren Diogi. I know that you know him quite well. I'm sure a lot of the listeners will know him quite well. He seems to be, you know, in a way, Abdul Nur seems, you know, he's maybe not as popular, but Darren Diogi seems to be popular wherever he goes somehow. I mean, I don't know how he does it, but he's a very popular figure. He seems to be, a sort of leadership candidate. When I've put it on there, the amount of people that have left comments saying this man should be Prime Minister, because he asked me to put his interviews on separately, so you can actually watch his interviews separate, which really, to me, you know, I don't think that it should be taken as separate, because you could take it out of context. It should be shown as the full thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of people, you know, they maybe push for time, or they just want to put it on their blog. I'm okay doing it if people want me to do it. I'm quite happy to do separate, cut things up and put them separately. But yeah, amazing. Yeah, he's got something about him, definitely.
He's working on all sorts of different levels, isn't he?
Yes.
I mean, there's his People's Public Trust badge, which is actually seeing so-called judges out of court just by being there. Because I think he describes it as being an unincorporated collection of ex-public servants, private trusts, and interested individuals who are seeking excellence in public service. Hmm. And for some reason, this really puts the wind up them. But the other thing of his that I really liked is he's saying, can there be a single person, is there anybody who isn't a bankster in this country who actually believes that we should have bailed the banks out? Because if there ain't, then why can't we have 8 million people signing up to a representative action that says, let's undo that? He says, if we get 8 million people, that's twice as many people maybe as who voted at the last election. That gives us a general representation. That means people will have to take it on board. And his ideas are serious. You can see that he's making a difference. Mm. You know, you can see that things work differently as a result of what Darren's doing. Very exciting, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the way he's the first person I put on the trailer, because he is so animated, because he is so sort of forceful with what he's saying. And he simply says, whose position does this represent? And then he just says, step forward. Let's see you. Mm. Step forward. Who are you? You know, who are these people? I mean, I don't even, you know, who are they? You know, it's amazing. We don't even know.
No.
You know, step forward. Let's see you.
Yeah.
These people that made these decisions. You know, it's not David Cameron and Nick Clegg. You know, Goldman these people Sachs. Way above them. Yeah, exactly. Step forward. So he's very animated. I'd advise people to look into his work, not just the People's Public Trust, but his other work too. His other work too. And I spoke to him recently on the social system. He's talking about, you know, the way society's going and the way we interact with each other, all sorts of issues. You know, he's run a gender workshop recently. He's putting a lot of work in.
Stuff on words and spells, doesn't he, as well,
words,
which is really
like
great.
That, you know, the collar cuffs and tie thing. I think that he makes a great point about the new economy. You know, people supporting radio shows like this, for example. Not just tuning in, but you know, spreading it out to other people, sending the link to other people, talking about it amongst, you know, your work colleagues or your family and things like that. You know, that is really important. If we're not prepared, you know, there's a lot of people out there that they're quite happy to shop at, you know, the evil that is Tesco kind of thing. Yeah. Mm. So you're giving your money to them, but really that money somehow should be channeled into these people that are doing some good, you know, and not to let people go without getting anything. You know, people, okay, we're doing this for nothing, aren't we? Yeah.
Yeah.
We're up here because we care, basically. Yeah. Right. But that can't continue forever. Because we'll end up just burning ourselves out, or we'll end up not with anything, you know, to feed our families with. Mm. You know, we've got to somehow support the new economy. And he's brave enough to step forward and say, yes, people, this is what we need to do. And I know that maybe everyone's like saying, oh, well, yeah, whatever. But it's important. This movement has to grow and it has to move forward. And I think he's someone that that is well worth looking into. And his comments, what follows, I mean, he talks about the People's Public Trust there. Which again, you know, I'd advise people to look into. There's been a lot of excitement about that, a lot of people wanting to get involved. But again, he makes the point, he's had to do a lot of the work. You know, you want people to come forward and do some of the work. But then, which we've sort of touched on, his comments on the Occupy. In fact, he's one of the people in the documentary who's, you know, people are very impressed with the comments, the way he comes across, and he's really got some deep insight into a lot of the things, yeah. And that's, I think, is because he covers things at a lot of different levels.
I think also one of the points that I've heard him make several times is there needs to be a different, we don't want to, whatever it is, you can think what you want at home, but in a public space you need to be calm, you need to be putting across ideas that are not going to scare people off. So you can be what you like at home, but when you're in the public arena, it needs to be something that is not going to freak people out, it's not going to send them running.
I think one of the things he uses is the mum test, which is a good test. Can you tell your mum about this information? You know, I couldn't particularly, you know, maybe start having a conversation with giant 7-foot reptiles, human eating human flesh, maybe with, or the grandmother test, say, we say with my grandmother, for example, that I could talk to her about George Orwell, you know, because she knows who he is, he's a recognised author. Oh, well, do you realise what he was saying about this? Mm. What he was talking about that? You know, I can talk to her about the fact that, oh, isn't it strange all the local shops have gone since Tesco opened, you know, things like this. Hopefully this conversation we've had, we've kept it reasonably grounded. These are things that are going on in the community. Just look at your own community around you.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's important as well. Because, I mean, Darren will be the first to admit he does have some way out stuff out there as well, you know. But it is important to keep it grounded. I think that all really, what I'd just like to say really, you know, you've got Michael Hallam, you've got Brian Gerrish and Roger Hayes, the British Constitution, you've got the group in Blackpool. I don't want to name one specific person there, but if you watch it on the documentary, you can pick people yourself. And anyone in the local area, I'd certainly advise to go along to their meetings. You've got Abdul Nur. What I'd ask people there is just look past the Islam thing, you know.
Definitely.
Try and get past it. Try and get past that and get to what he's actually saying.
And actually, we have to do a lot of that. We have to get past our own prejudices. We have to get past the fact that some of the things that are being said are maybe not immediately accessible or acceptable to us. And we need to be listening and participating with people who are, you know, working. People who are working for a solution, almost whoever they are.
Yeah.
We need to be working with them and supporting them, because as we go forward, we will find out what works.
Yeah.
You know, and whilst we're only talking about it, it's theory. But as we do the practical, we'll find out what works. I think we already are.
Yeah, I think it'll become self-evident, won't it? Mm. You know, this quote from Schopenhauer, it'll be ridiculed. It will be. We've got to face violent opposition at some point, but eventually it will just become self-evident. This system will be self-evident to people eventually.
Blindingly obvious.
And same with the solutions. Same with the solutions, because we've covered all these people. These people are covered in the documentary, and it might turn out that. Some of the people aren't right, and it may turn out a solution that we haven't even thought of yet is right. Who knows? But it's really important that we give these people a voice, and it's really important. I hope that everyone's listening tonight will follow the link that you've posted, will have a look at it, and will have a look at what some of these people are saying. I know that the full thing is long, but if you can dip in and out of it, you don't need to watch it all at once.
And it is very useful to have it all in kind of one sort of format, so that you actually get a chance to see actually what the similarities and differences are between one person and another.
Mm.
Well,
we've only got to part two of episode one.
We have. Well,
part three of episode one.
Perhaps you'll have to come back, Grayling. What do you reckon?
Oh, absolutely. I'd be delighted to come back. We can cover new communities. We can cover the free man movement in more detail.
Debt free banking.
Episode two.
I haven't had a chance to look at in detail yet. I'd love you to come back and talk some more. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. The time's shot by. Thanks, Grayling, for being with me. Thanks, obviously, to TNS for, as ever, being generous enough to provide me the space to do this. And thanks, most of all, to all of you for being there and for listening and being so enthusiastic. Without you, there would be no show.